All right, welcome to Dorkbot. We're here at the Encounter Studio. They were kind enough to give us space for our time this week, so I guess month. So thank you very much for the space down here. We also have a donation bar in the back if anybody wants a drink. And please give donations for the space and for Dorkbot so we can keep doing this. Tonight we have for you Incoherence, which is a really interesting audio mixing application, and hood.theory.org, which will be our first speaker after the screensaver comes off. Which is an interesting, we'll see, it's an interesting presentation about what you can do with mapping and sort of social information and mapping. After the talks, we'll have some open dork and then milling around if people want to stay. And again, please do have a donation. It sort of lets us run this thing because it's not entirely free to do, and the spaces donate their time for us for free. And we do this for you as free as we can, which is, you know, your donation. So I'd like to introduce Matt and Ross with hood.theory.org.
You can set it. Let's go. Okay, so this is the neighborhood project. So about 3 years ago, I moved to Divisadero and Hayes and found a lot of people asking me exactly what neighborhood I lived in. And I would say kind of, it's halfway between Upper Haight and Lower Haight, and it's also just east of the Panhandle and just south of Western Addition and just over the hill from Hayes Valley. And what I really found is there's a neat little neighborhood there, and there's no real neighborhood name for it. And it's just kind of, it's either in several different neighborhoods or it's in its own neighborhood that has no name. And so I was wondering, everyone was wondering what neighborhood it was. So we went to the San Francisco official neighborhoods map. And that didn't help at all because it put me a block away from the four corners between Buena Vista, Lower Haight, Alamo Square, and Panhandle, which really didn't help at all. So I came up with this. And the way it works is very simple. There's a scraper that pulls down housing posts off Craigslist every 5 minutes. And it uses a regular expression to pull out the neighborhood name and the location, so the address or an intersection more often. And then it uses the free geocoder at geocoder.us to turn those addresses and intersections into latitude and longitude, and it draws them on the map. And it draws them on the map using what's called the Blobby algorithm, which Ross implemented. And now we're going to look at the map. So this is a map of a lot of things. First, I will show off. I live about here, and you can see it's kind of hard to read. This is Alamo Square, NOPA. This is Lower Haight, and it extends up there. USF Panhandle comes here. Haight-Ashbury comes within a block of where I live. Hayes Valley comes within about half a block of where I live. Western Addition comes down within a block of where I live. So really the answer is I live in six neighborhoods. The colors are chosen right now. Actually, I can show the key. It just picks a bunch of colors basically randomly. It runs through and kind of picks ones as far apart as possible. Unfortunately, there are so many neighborhoods. There's 35 neighborhoods on the map that it's really, the colors aren't really very good, but there's so many that I have to use lots of colors. It is. It's not doing it very well because I'm not the best person with graphics in the world. But you can see, so this green is Lower Pacific Heights, and that's Pacific Heights. And this green in here is them overlapping. But as soon as you get more than two colors overlapping, it stops doing blending. So, improving the colors would be one major improvement to this. There's a bunch of interesting stuff. It's funny stuff like someone living in the middle of Golden Gate Park. Then there's things like this down here, This is, so that gray dot, if you look up here, is a Richmond Seacliff dot that's totally in the wrong neighborhood. And there's actually a bunch of those. Sometimes.
Is there people that pretend?
Well.
Or strangers?
It's interesting. If you think about it, this is not just a map of where people think their neighborhood is. It's a map of where people want you to think their neighborhood is because they're trying to rent their place on Craigslist. So there's nothing listed in like the Tenderloin at all because and there's not the neighborhood does not exist according to Craigslist. There's not a lot of stuff in Bayview down here. There's not a tremendous amount of stuff in the Excelsior. Oops. Oh, it doesn't. Yeah. There's not a tremendous amount of stuff down there. That goes into something else I wanted to say. This is a map of a lot of things. It's a map of housing density. It's a map of turnover rate. So out here in the Sunset and the Richmond, you can see this has been collecting data for 2 years almost with a several month gap because Craigslist changed their HTML and I didn't notice. The regular expression didn't work anymore. But you can see, so compare the density here in Richmond Seacliff and in the Sunset to the Mission and Noe Valley and Castro and even up here in Pacific Heights and up into the Marina. Those neighborhoods are much higher density, so they tend to be almost entirely 3- and 4-story apartment buildings and flats, whereas out here it's, you know, 2-story, 2-bedroom houses or 2-bedroom units or even single-family homes out there. So those are more likely to be owned properties, not rental properties, and there's more people, there's much more people living per address out there. What else? Van Ness, right in here, is a very clear divider. So you can see that the Marina, Pacific Heights, Russian Hill, Knob Hill, Lower Knob Hill, all of these basically, I'm running the mouse along Van Ness, they basically stop at Van Ness. So people have a very clear idea that Van Ness divides these neighborhoods. In here, this is mostly public housing in these blocks in here. And you would expect, I guess, that places for rent don't come up on Craigslist if they're in public housing very often. And then down here, this is where all the city administration buildings are. Nobody lives down there. This is Financial District. You can see where there's a surprising number of places for rent down there because that's all office buildings, or at least I thought it was all office buildings. This is Chinatown, where people do live, but apparently they don't use Craigslist to post. I don't have any idea why. Lower Knob Hill, actually, is funny. It's this kind of, this color here. And it's hard to see with these colors, but the neighborhood is completely contained in either downtown Civic Van Ness and Knob Hill. So it's a completely, Craigslist should remove it from their database because it's a completely superfluous neighborhood. When I started this, Alamo Square and NOPA, that neighborhood didn't exist. There's a new restaurant called NOPA, and people have started calling the neighborhood NOPA. And one of the things we did when we wrote the program, we made it detect new neighborhood names. So if people start using a neighborhood name on Craigslist a lot, the program will eventually pick it up and say, hey, I think this is actually a real neighborhood, and it'll start mapping it. So that happened a couple months ago, even though Craigslist added that neighborhood about 6 months ago. I think it happened about a month ago that it started showing up on the map. So let's see. I could probably speculate about the map for an hour about all the different reasons for various things. Does anybody have comments or questions? Or
I have a question about the map of the city of Alamo. I've never heard of this until like a few months ago.
It basically started a few months ago.
Yeah. So, is it started? Is that possible?
we're calling the NOPA means North of the Panhandle. There's a North of the Panhandle newsletter, and people were calling it NOPA before that, but the restaurant, which is right on my corner, got a lot of press. It's a very fancy restaurant, and it's kind of created the neighborhood. And the neighborhood's been changed in the last 6 months, too. So. People refer to that. I don't think there's any data, or there's certainly not enough Craigslist posts in the Tender Knob for it to draw a neighborhood. There might be a few. But I've actually been looking in the database from time to time, and there's not very many.
Back there.
So this, what we're seeing here is an aggregation of all the data over the last few
years? Yes.
Have you looked at it over time?
No, I want to do that. Yeah, I don't have lots of free time, but it would be really cool to do an animation and show the neighborhood's change. And actually, one thing I'd be really interested in is whether when Alamo Square is introduced as a neighborhood on Craigslist, whether the number of posts in the surrounding neighborhoods go down slowly.
It sounds like it's another pattern. Time of your work.
Oh, yes.
And for a craft for a neighborhood.
That would be really interesting. Yeah. That would be, yes. Oh, okay. He said there are probably yearly patterns to where when people move. So close to USF and UCSF, there would probably be high turnover in September and June, and probably lots of open places posted in the summer. So if you did a time series, you'd be able to see spurts in certain areas at certain times. So, you've got it, yeah.
Are the colors, is the saturation showing density of, like, multiple posts layered on top of each other?
No, it's not anywhere near that.
The blobby algorithm is essentially, if you have a single dot, it just shows up as a circle, but if you have two near each other, then they kind of blob together and form a larger surface. I can go into that if you really want to know how that works. Those O's are addresses which have no neighborhood associated with them. And so if they've been posted and somebody left off that information.
One thing. Yeah, so these empty circles are addresses with no neighborhood. And one thing I was kind of wondering about is if people would just post their address and not pick a neighborhood if they didn't know where. So I was wondering if you'd see lots of these O's in areas outside neighborhoods, or if you'd see them clustering, say, along Van Ness, where the neighborhood's ambiguous, but you don't. They seem to just show up all over the place. So the only thing is that down here in Bayview, there's not very many posts at all. So this purple is Bayview. And there's not very many posts in Bayview, but there's a lot of posts outside the neighborhood, so maybe people who live there are less likely to say what neighborhood it is when they post, as opposed to, say, the Mission, where there's huge numbers of posts that say the neighborhood. So.
If you had a third dimension,
I actually saw you could do peaks for how many posts have come up in certain blocks and things, so you'd have kind of a mountainous landscape on top. That would be one thing. I don't know, do you have an idea?
No, I was just seeing what you thought.
Okay.
You said your interest kind of changed over time.
Yeah, I mean, you could do, I guess that would be better shown with an animation, though. This Zoom thing, I pulled it off of some other map site. It's JavaScript. There's a clipping region that moves as you move the mouse. So, okay, so you're.
Yeah. I write for our med blog, San Francisco, and we've been working on this post content for a while, where we're hitting people up to name the no-name neighborhoods. There's the people that live in the neighborhoods to name them. So, for instance, like the neighborhood between Lower Haight and Castro, people have been calling it Haightsboro or Castrate.
Yeah.
And also, I grew up in Haight, and the neighborhood that you live in, as far as I know locally, for the past 10 years, has been called the Goth Ghetto.
Goth Ghetto. Wow. I should look for that in Craigslist. Yeah, somehow. Okay, there was a question over here.
Oh, I was going to ask the same thing, addressing, like, not the mission, but the mission with an N, or the tender knob, or tranny pipes, or anything like that.
There.
Kind of thing where people nickname things.
Yeah. Well, I would think that the pattern would be first a slang term comes up because there's no good term for that name for that area, and then it gets popular enough that someone at Craigslist notices and puts it in, and then it becomes.
I think the alphabet sort of village.
That could be. Yes. Yes. Okay.
What?
That's probably where NOPA came from, ultimately. Craigslist does have houses for sale on it, but would be a good idea to scrape real estate sites. Also, the website, I won't show it, but the website has a little form where you can put in your address and your neighborhood, and that's been collecting data as well, much, much slower. But it would be neat to, at this point, graph that and see how it differed. So, because that would just be a map of where people think they live, not where renters and real estate agents think people want to live. So, okay.
Have you tried looking at the cost of renting for a neighborhood so that you could just track trends and say the optimal time to move or things like that?
That would be cool. I haven't done that. The data we've been collecting doesn't have that, so I haven't been pulling that out. It probably would be, yeah, you just look for dollar sign and some numbers, and yeah. Okay, two questions back there.
What if people online want to know how often you refresh your
face? Oh, the map is redrawn every night. So, yes.
Have you ever tried overlaying zip code? Is there any more than what people think?
I have no idea. There's a rough correlation between the official neighborhood maps of the city and some of the neighborhoods, but not super official, not super good connection. Something else, there's another area up here, right in here and here along the water. And actually you can see here, there's no posts here that are actually on whatever this street is in the marina. And there's no posts up here. And this is the very top of Pacific Heights, where the really expensive mansions are. And so you would think that people living up there aren't selling their homes. They're not renting them. They're not. And if they are, they're not using Craigslist for it. This is also a really posh neighborhood in here, right along the back of the Presidio.
Where is Richmond so
good? What?
Why is Richmond so
good? Oh, okay. So, yeah, out here there are these streaks that run along the east-west streets. And my thinking on why this is happening is that the blocks are really narrow, and Craigslist encourages you to put it in an intersection, not an address. So if you live in the middle of a block here between these two streets, between the two big streets, you're just going to put it in an intersection, so you're much more likely to get points along the east-west streets than in the middle. The other explanation for that may be that you're more likely to find big apartment buildings on corners rather than in the middle of the block. And I think that is actually true out there. If you go down Geary or one of the streets out here, the apartment buildings will be on the corners, and in the middle of the block, it'll just be, you know, two-unit or three-unit homes. So.
Okay. I think it's pretty telling that in the Bayview, there are hardly any dots, and there are no black people here in Thorpe Bus. Black people in Craigslist, and there aren't as many computers down there.
Yeah.
And that's something that I don't know, would be interesting to look into and see if you can map economics and race within this map and see how that relates to computer usage.
Where's Chinatown?
Yeah, well, the other thing I pointed out is Chinatown, where, you know, it's not necessarily a poor neighborhood, and it's certainly a high-density neighborhood, but people there aren't using Craigslist, and maybe it's because they don't have computers, or maybe it's because they have other ways of renting. Yeah, maybe it's a language thing. Yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. That would be another source to scrape, although that would be really time-consuming. So, yeah. Are we up on time? Are there more questions? Or?
You're doing okay on time.
Okay.
Go longer or stop if you want.
I think I've exhausted a lot of my rampant speculation. Some more interesting things about the data. There is Sunset District, and there's someone who's putting in. So let's see if I can find it. So this dot here, the little kind of orange one, and this one here, and that one there, those are in Sunset District. But all this blue is in Sunset Parkside. And so there's someone, I think, who has a couple of rental properties out in that neighborhood, and they really think that the neighborhood is called Sunset District, not Sunset Parkside. And so they've put in enough posts to create a neighborhood. That's the only explanation for why this gets to be a neighborhood and there's only three or four posts. But there's only three or four actual locations. So
is this in public?
The source is available. I need to put up a new tarball. It's super, super beta. It was just a quick hack. It's not maybe a little difficult to work with, but it's up. Brandon?
What's the threshold for creating a neighborhood?
Okay, so the threshold for creating a neighborhood is if it figures out with the average number of posts per neighborhood. And if a new neighborhood has 10% that many posts, then it decides, okay, this counts as a new neighborhood and creates it and adds it.
What's that number?
The number's like 75 right now. Last I looked, because I was looking and watching, but it changes as the posts come in. So I was looking and watching because I knew that Craigslist had added Alamo Square and NOPA. And so I was watching the Alamo Square and NOPA posts and trying to figure out when it was going to become a neighborhood. So a month ago it was 75. It's probably 80 or 90 now. Something else that's funny. Everyone, or a number of people who've looked at this, immediately asked for a key, even though the neighborhood name is right on top of the neighborhood. My only thinking on this is that the neighborhood names are actually so close to where the real official neighborhoods are that people assume that means this is where the official neighborhood is, and this blob is some neighborhood that may or may not be that neighborhood. So. Did you?
Can you overlay streets? Is that built into it?
No. Another cool thing to do with this would be to take this data and overlay it on Google Maps or something. The background image is just a map I pulled off of a government website, and I used it because I was able to get the latitude and longitude exactly on the map.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about how you built this? Just like what went into creating it? How long
ago? It didn't take very long. It was just, it's just a couple of Python scripts and a database and just thrown together. You can look at the code if you want. It's not, yeah.
Sorry, this might be a difficult question. But when you mouse over the various color areas, does the tooltip, is there a tooltip view of what either the unique neighborhood is or the mixture of neighborhoods that color is?
No, that would be really cool to have also. But yeah. I've thought about a bunch of different ways to make the data more manageable, but it's all time that I don't have, really. So if somebody wants to make it better, go for it. Yeah.
Did you say that this is every post for the last 2 years?
So it was collecting data. I don't remember exactly when we started. It collected data for about a year and a half, and then it fell down for about 6 months. Craigslist changed their HTML pretty radically, and the regular expression completely stopped working. And then about a month and a half ago, I noticed that it had fallen down and went in and fixed it. So.
You don't die away with time or anything.
No, but it would be really cool to do a time.
Yeah, you just have to look for mouth.
No, there's actually another website that does that. It's also taking Craigslist housing posts, and it'll give you. It uses Google Maps, and it will give you a map of the city and show you where all the posts are. What's it called? Housingmaps.com. So, all right, I think that's the project. Oh, and the website is hood.theory.org.
So that again was hood.theory.org, or the neighborhood project, and that was Matt and Roth. Mm-hmm. And this is my daughter, and she wants to talk on the microphone, apparently. Do you want to tell people something?
Yes.
What do you want to tell people?
Pink.
You have to speak into the microphone if you want to tell people stuff.
The kangaroos and forgot their tails, their pro sticks a long time ago, and it was just. And just took a rock and ate it all up. And then a big kangaroo did it. And just the kangaroos got.
All right, there's your interim entertainment. So next up we have Incoherence, which is, I've actually seen Prevent once before at CodeCon, and it was really a fantastic talk, one of the better talks at CodeCon ever, and I hope they don't let me down this time. I'm sure they won't. It's a really great product that shows audio visualization in stereo and really lets you see stuff about the mix in audio that you really can't see any other way, and they've got some great examples for you to show you some cool music and stuff, I'm sure, and this is a Greg and Steve, you can have your turn afterwards, okay, Bella? So again, Incoherence. Oh, and remember, there is the bar, and please donate. Both to the bar. Oh, okay. Thanks to Monkey Brains for streaming live video.
Hi. Hello. Okay, as John said, this is called Incoherence. It's a product that we made under the name of OMG Audio. We really only have one product, but there are other little plugins and stuff that you can get off our website, so omgaudio.com for people that are interested. And let me talk a little bit about where we started. First of all, this is Steve, my brother, and my name is Greg. I was going to audio engineering school a couple of years ago in 2004, and a lot of the people that work there are used to stereo mixing bands in recording studios where largely the equipment is analog and there's no visualization of any sort, spectrum analyzers or anything else for mixing music. One of the ways that people talked about visualizing the sound in their head is a pretty intuitive fashion. Obviously, the most intuitive being when there's a sound coming out of a left-hand speaker, you feel like the sound is coming from that direction because physically it is. The same with the right hand on the other side. People also seem to pretty universally say that when a sound is louder, it sounds like it's closer to you. When a sound is quieter, it sounds like it's farther away. And the last property, which is, I would say, pretty obvious, is that sound mixers were saying that high frequencies sounded like they were up high and low frequencies sounded like they were down low. I think this is largely due to the fact that low frequency travels through tables and the floor and stuff like that. So you can actually feel objects vibrate when low frequency information is going on. So after talking to Steve about this for a little while, we realized that one of the dimensions, frequency, is pretty well played out in spectrum analyzers, the bar graphs that you see on stereo equipment, that'll tend to have low frequencies on one side and high frequencies on the other side, and they've got a bar for each individual frequency. So if you whistle into one of these things, a bar goes up in the center at the frequency that you're whistling. We realized that you could take that information and plot it in a 3D graph and have that frequency information from bottom to top, like I was talking about a second ago, and the panning information, the left and right information, mapped to the sides of the screen, and you could plot a dot that was proportional in size to the amplitude. So if a sound is louder, it'll be closer towards you. So to demonstrate some of these things, Steve's going to play a few short clips that I made. I apologize if they're a little bit hard to listen to. They're just plain tones. So what you'll see here is a dot pretty much in the center of the screen. Turn the mains down. That's 260 hertz, and it's center panned, and there's no phase information whatsoever, so it's just basically one dot. We're going to play another one. Okay, we can do this one. This is a sweep from 20 hertz to 5,000 hertz. It might sound like this is about to hurt, but I promise it won't. You saw the dot getting smaller at the top there because it faded out. The next one is just modulating the amplitude, so the volume gets louder and quieter, which you can hear pretty audibly. Okay, the next one is panning modulation, or just panning back and forth. You should see this dot move from the left to right of screen and back. Okay, two more, maybe one. So phase is one of the more difficult concepts to understand on this graph. Phase information in audio is essentially the same waveform being played at a different time. And the human brain uses this information to decide where a sound came from. So if something occurs right in front of you, you're going to hear it in both ears pretty much simultaneously. But if something occurs off to one side, you're going to hear that in your left ear before you hear it in your right ear. So, right. So in large rooms where somebody's making a noise and then it bounces off a wall and you hear it, that bounce takes longer to get to your ear. So if you're hearing a lot of phase distortion, what it sounds like is stuff is all around you. So the way we chose to represent this, because you can't know where the sound originated, is to separate the dot. And we separate it based off the actual distance that you would have to place two sounds for them to sound that far apart. So what you'll see here is a series of steps of phase difference. It'll start kind of near the center and then get farther out of phase and farther out of phase. It's probably going to be hard to hear on this sound setup. It's a lot easier if you have headphones on, but you should hear slight differences in the tone in the note. And go ahead and play the other one. I've got another one up higher. Phase distortion in higher frequencies is a little bit more locatable. Okay, could anyone tell the difference between those tones? Yeah? Okay. Right. To me here, it sounded like the amplitude was just changing. It sounded like it was a little bit quieter because I'm not hearing a lot of the speaker. So we're going to move on now to audio, some actual songs that have been composed, stuff you guys probably know from someplace or another. One of the most interesting things to look at in Incoherence is electronic music. They tend to separate their instruments really well. They have really simple tones. And so everything is really discrete. You can identify instruments pretty readily. So I'm going to play an electronic piece. What you're seeing on the right there is the harmonics of the instrument above the fundamental note. Thank you. Can someone tell me the stereo is right? Does that sound like it's over there? Okay.
I'm just going to show you some of what you can see in different recordings, give you a hint of what this might be used for. So first up, we've got an old mono recording. So mono obviously goes right up the center, no left or right information on it, but you can see the frequency stuff, and you've probably seen something that looks like this on really old stereos or car stereos. They used to have a series of LEDs that would do pretty much what you're looking at there. Boom, 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 boom. I'm gonna shoot you right down. We're all for you. So the next thing I'm going to show you is a really basic stereo recording. It's actually an acetate of the Beatles that nobody knows where it came from. A friend of mine has an uncle who's in recording, and they found it somewhere. So this is Let It Be in a really early, non-mixed, just two-microphone recording. And one of the features you'll see here is the way it was recorded is clear from what you see on the screen. They had two microphones in the same place but pointing different directions, so that when the sound wave arrived, it hit one microphone at a different point in the wave than it hit the other one, or the microphone went in a different direction. The physical surface diaphragm of the microphone went in a different direction. So there was a constant difference in the phase between the two microphones, and different sounds at constant phase have to be a different distance out of phase, so it actually sounds like they're farther apart in lower frequencies, where being the same percentage out of phase means that the physical waves are farther apart out of phase. So what you're seeing in this Y shape here is their microphone set up when they were recording this. So next I'm going to show you an early stereo recording. In early stereo, they tended to just put instruments on one side or the other. And so here you've got a guitar and another instrument over there, and sitars over here. And what you're seeing in the middle is phase interference between the two channels. So the two sounds playing together make it sounds in the same frequencies, so that it kind of sounds as if maybe what you're hearing is something at that frequency echoing off a wall or something, but in fact it's just two different things coming off of two different frequencies. And this one is fun. It was recorded pretty much the same way. Go ahead and play it. Recorded pretty much the same way. You see some instruments are panned all the way over here. Some of them are all the way over there. There are actually a few in the middle on this one. This is a slightly later recording. But an interesting thing happened during the making of this recording. They had a recording of some talking that they wanted to overlay on the music that they did for the original mono mix. But then when they made the stereo mix, they realized that they'd lost that tape, and they could no longer put that over the recording, so they couldn't make a totally separate stereo mix. So it starts out in full stereo, with the vocals up the center, different instruments on either side. You can see there's a snare of some kind over on the upper left. A hi-hat, yeah. But in the middle of the song, when they get to the part where they play the voice recording, they had to switch to a fake stereo, where they took a mono recording, put it in a room, put microphones around it, and recorded it, so there's phase interference. And then they panned it around so it's in different places in the stereo field. But really what you're looking at is a stereo recording of a mono source. So I'll put you right at the point where the transition happens. Whoops. That's close enough. I am the Eggman.
coming out of the other side of this bridge. It's all fake stereo. And it's like this for the rest of the song. And I'm not sure whether you're going to be able to hear this. But on headphones, at least, it actually sounds quite different between the end of the song and the beginning of the song. And I'll flip back and forth a little bit later. Okay, so next, modern stereo recording. People actually place instruments very carefully, and the big thing in stereo recording since the 80s has been to use as much of the stereo field as possible, actually since Phil Spector. The idea being that you fill up the entire frequency spectrum and the entire panning range with sound to make the whole thing sound very loud and have a lot of impact, which was used to great effect in music from the early 90s, where that contrast was used to play up volume differences. So the whole thing in early 90s grunge music was loud, soft, loud, where there would be a quiet part of the song and then a very loud part, and they would contrast them not just with volume, but with clever studio trickery, which you can see right here. Wasn't actually a big volume difference that you just heard. What you actually heard was more of the stereo feel being used. So next I want to talk about voices. Voices show up very differently. Depending on different instruments, a guitar would be pretty much just a point with a couple of little points above it on that screen, and a snare drum would be a big splash of dots around the top. And the most interesting things are things that sound kind of like the human voice. So I'm going to show you a really good recording of the human voice. All the instruments are on the sides, the extreme sides, and then the voice comes in straight up the middle. And what you'll see is a lot of harmonics. The human voice doesn't come in at a particular frequency. It actually has a very broad frequency spectrum. You'll see the main tone of the voice down toward the middle of the screen, and above that are a lot of harmonics of the voice. And then at the very top, extremely loud, actually, are fricatives and sibilants, so F and S sounds. Big bar that shows up when she says "I sound."
Crazy for feeling so good.
But the majority of her voice is right there.
I knew you'd love me as long as you.
Also, a really great instrument and good for a lot of the same reasons is the saxophone, which actually sounds quite a bit like a human voice. Has lots and lots of harmonics, which actually come in at good frequencies that sound pleasing. So what you'll see here is kind of a comb shape when the saxophone comes in. Really distinct bands where there's a bass frequency and then a certain step above that is the next one, and the step above that is the next one. And during this part, you can actually see it climbing up and down the scale of frequencies. And one last thing I wanted to show you is one of the studio tricks people use called coherence, which incoherence is named after. That's where you put two sounds in exactly the same position in the stereo field, left, right, and at the same frequency, and they overlap, which makes them sound as if they're a single sound. what you'll hear here shortly after Mick Jagger says 1-2 kind of look right around there. There's a guitar and a piano, which play at the same time. The piano gives a little more kick to the riff. And it can be a little bit hard to pull apart the two sounds in your brain because they're coming in exactly the same place. So next we're just going to show you some stuff that looks cool. So there's places where the dots were spread all across the screen. The voice had a whole lot of echo on it. So there were lots of copies of the same sound coming in, just slightly offset. So there was a lot of phase distortion, and it made the sound sound like it was more all around you than the straight up the middle sound you're hearing right now. I'm not sure what that swirly sound is at the top, but it's probably some kind of stereo flanger. Okay, so now Greg is going to show you just some of the different things that the software does. We've had it in a really basic mode here, and there's a lot of config options.
First, I'm going to kind of relate it to something that you guys know already, or something that I was talking about earlier, at least. The points that you're seeing are pretty highly configurable. You can pick what they look like and what shape they are and what color they are and whatever. But one of the things that the application was built to look a little bit like was a spectrum analyzer. So I'm going to simulate one. This is a couple of discrete panning bands. You can see there's only 5 different places that a dot can be. I'm actually going to drop that down to just 1. And what you're seeing is kind of a double-sided spectrum analyzer. And you get to pick the number of frequency bands over here. Unfortunately, the application goes much higher than the screen can render. Oh, one other thing I can show here is we have a ruler, so you can tell exactly what frequency something's at, and a tooltip that'll tell you exactly which frequency you're looking at. There's a graphic display right here that you can see. This is around 200 hertz, and up here we have 2,000 hertz right here. We have a switchable FFT for standard window size functions. Pretty much all the functions you'll find in a spectrum analyzer, since we're actually doing an FFT on the sound. So you can do a really high-quality FFT. It's much less responsive, but you get much more interesting frequency information out of it. You can do it over time, so you see a good picture of the swirly phaser or flanger effect that's going on up there. And if you go really low, you get extremely responsive, but low frequency information, so you see a lot of dots lacking at the bottom. Thank you. song where the artist started with a couple of samples that were obviously mono, and he's playing them in the stereo field and panning them around individually. So you see a lot of lines moving back and forth, some staying in the center for the drum track. To the human ear. Unfortunately, it turns out that so many people have different opinions about this that there's no good answer.
From nice military men in white suits, have you received?
Absolutely none. Is that the right answer? I believe that. Yeah, none.
Because this display that they're showing is very much like a classified display that's used on submarines to determine where all the other things in the ocean are. This is how you display information for aquaponics.
Right. So because you can use panning information, basically amplitude differences, and also phase information to locate the sound, putting up two microphones, even if they're relatively close to each other, you can have a pretty good idea of where a sound is. If you put up a third, you can do a little bit of distance monitoring of it. Any other questions? Way in the back.
Are we getting the change up in the FFT?
Yeah, so we're transforming a stereo signal, which has two channels. We're doing an FFT on it, and you get a real and imaginary component. Way back in the back there in the orange shirt.
Unwrapping the phase?
I'm sorry?
Are you unwrapping the phase?
Unwrapping?
Yeah.
Yes. So you get back, you feed in real data, you get back complex data, which gives you an angle around the unit circle. And yeah, we're adjusting for where the thing is around the unit circle. And, you know, it can only go around once, right?
Okay, now orange shirt, I think red maybe.
Would it be possible to draw a region of interest on the screen display and only play sounds that fall into that region?
Right, so I think what you're talking about is something that we had considered, which is modifying the screen in ways, like he was saying, defining essentially a clipping region, applying an audio effect to strip out that clipping, what isn't in that clipping region, and then reproducing that audio that you have a result in. Of course, that would take a lot more development effort, but we are headed in a direction like that. So,
and one of our ideas is to plug it into a digital audio workstation so that you can have a number of stereo tracks feeding into it independently, and they can be colorized separately. So you can see, oh, well, the bass is blue and the guitar is red and so on.
Any other questions?
Mapping this onto a color
space? Mapping it onto color space. Which dimension? Which specifically? Like, what would you represent with color? Right. There is actually one project that does a mapping onto a unit circle for phase information. So what you see is a circle and sounds in the center if they're quiet, and near the outside if they're loud towards a specific channel, and the phase can also move that around. I forget what that's called, but it's available.
Are there any buttons to show history? Like if the same notes hit twice in a second, it leaves like a different color or a brighter image there?
There's a visualization fade off. We also have a dot based fade off, but it leaves a trail of where the dot was over time. Since we're rotating through the colors, you can see old notes in a different color, what it was when it was drawing the actual dot. Is that what you were looking for?
Exactly.
Good. any other questions? Yes.
When you showed that panning, I couldn't hear the panning, but when I saw it, it looked kind of cheap, like low budget.
The song we played at the very end?
That panning, where you could see that, you know, that sinusoidal panning.
Oh, at the very beginning. I'm not sure which one you're referring to, but I should mention a couple things about panning. At the very beginning, when we were moving a dot back and forth, you could see actually some dots surrounding it. That's because of the way that the waveform is changing volume in the two speakers, it's not exactly accurate. It would take a pretty high-quality interpolator to get that right. So you see dots form around it. You probably also saw dots form above and below the dots, the main dot, because of harmonic information. Specifically, if you were to clip off a waveform without fading it out, you would get a lot of high-frequency distortion, and you would get a large line that shot up the screen. I built at one point a tone generator to play with incoherence, and I learned a lot about the different mistakes that you can make and how visible they are in the application. Yes?
Over time, as you've been using it, can you turn down the sound and guess what the music might be that has been visualized by it?
Right. So one of the things that it's really easy to visualize is what it will sound like in your ears, but one of the things that's hard to imagine is the rhythm or content of the music. As you noticed, even when we played voice and guitars and stuff, you could place frequencies, but you didn't know if that was a guitar or a saxophone or a piano, except for some basic characteristics, and you especially can't tell the rhythm they're playing or if it's a human voice, what they were saying. Yes?
I read the invite more closely. I probably know this, but can I have it?
Yes, well, sort of. OMGAudio.com, there are plugins for every major media player, Winamp, iTunes, Windows Media Player, and there is a standalone version which does the input monitoring that we were using here, also analyzes static files and has all the options I've been playing with for sale. Yes?
I have a question about that. So how hard is it to do, maybe you could call it beat extraction or something like that?
Did you ask the question about the Winamp plugin on the forum? Oh, okay. Someone did about beat detection. There are a number of different algorithms for it of varying quality. Nullsoft, the people who make Winamp, actually give one away. They have a plugin which is for beat detection, and they have a pretty good algorithm. We played with beat detection in terms of identifying specific instruments in the field, but unfortunately, that's too computationally expensive to do real time.
Could you kind of visually see something, just kind of usually like snare drums and things like that, will just shoot up into the top. Right? Mm-hmm. So. Like, you spend a lot of time with this, but can you pretty much see the beat just by looking at it?
Yeah, usually. One of the big ways that beat detectors work, can you throw it in linear mode? Well, this isn't a very good example. Well, there you go. Most of the sound information that's actually contained in the wave file, you don't really hear much of. The human ear works on a logarithmic scale, so low sounds sound way more important to your ear than they are in the air. And most of the beat actually occurs through the entire frequency spectrum. So there's all this information that's music that's happening down in this relatively unimportant small area of the frequency spectrum, but the beat tends to go all the way up. So one of the ways people detect beats starting out is just to look at extremely high frequency information. It goes all the way up because it's hitting a drum, which causes all sorts of things to rattle and vibrate and at all different frequencies. Related to what you were talking about earlier, one of our ideas for future effort, we would have to pre-render songs this way. You'd have to throw in a wave and wait a while. But something that would be fun to do is try to do frequency correlation between the different frequency bands. So you take something that's playing in some low band and you see how it correlates with something that's playing in some higher band, and you color similar things similarly, which maybe could kind of pull out different voices and colorize them separately.
So one thing I was trying to show here, but unfortunately the ruler is being cut off the side of the screen, is about the highest frequency that this song plays. Since this is a linear scale, the majority of what you're hearing is down here, and this is a pretty good picture of the high end of the audio. Particularly this song cuts off. That tooltip is wrong. This song stops playing interesting information just under 6K. There's a little bit of noise that comes in here, but still that's only 16K. If you look at MP3, a song that's been MP3 that actually had information up there, you see a pretty distinct line right here around 16K, which is where MP3 does its low pass. That's where the low pass cutoff is. Are there any other questions? Yes. There are a lot of pieces of hardware designed for that specifically because voice is usually recognizable. It's usually a specific section of frequency. And you can also cancel out the stuff right in the middle pretty simply. Unfortunately, in some of the tracks we've been playing, that's drums as well. So you have to be careful about what frequency and
like India, for example, you can't use it. That function does not work on some music because the voice is all over the place. It's not in the middle where it cuts it out.
Exactly. You would see that move across the screen. You would see a large band that represented her voice instead of a single line in the middle.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Repeat the question.
I think what you asked is whether or not there are songs that reproduce images in audio, audio visualization software. And the, I think the most popular case I can think of is Aphex Twin did a song, A Complex Mathematical Equation is the joke name. It actually is a complex mathematical equation that I haven't memorized, where he had a piece of software that displayed frequency information over time. So if I remember correctly, it's the same dimension for frequency as we have from the bottom to the top. But then he would render a dot and then move this cursor forward in time and draw dots when they occurred. So what he actually did is he drew his face by having different frequencies play at different times to draw vertical lines that would represent a face. And it was pretty convincing. There's a piece of software for doing the opposite that he was using at the time that I forget the name of, but it actually takes any image you want and turns it into that frequency time domain information.
Question?
Yes?
Have you been able to use this to visualize like the differences of compression of MP3 versus like the stuff used for iTunes and that sort of thing? Anything obvious?
Right. There are a couple obvious things. Like I said earlier, MP3 does a 16K cutoff, depending on which compressor that you're using, but it's pretty common. And that's the only super visual effect that you can notice with MP3. With AUG, there's something that I consider to be a bit more terrible, which is that so the phase information that I was showing you earlier, where the dots would separate and then they would come back together, you can be anywhere from totally in center to totally out of phase, any position along that line. But what AUG does is it strips out that phase information, and there are five discrete steps. You can either be entirely in phase, I think 90 degrees and 180, and that's it. So that saves them some compression time. And if you're listening on headphones, you can actually hear that sort of a thing if somebody is specifically doing something with phase or if you're trying to locate an instrument. Like if you listen to symphonic recordings, which use phase quite a bit, just in terms of you being a member of an audience inside of a room where there are very low and very high frequency sounds being produced from a specific location, the stereo image kind of goes all to hell. You can't tell where instruments are anymore. Any other questions? Yes?
Non-stereo phase visualization where you have quad and more, you all hear about 5.1, 7.1, the center channel, more and more phase information becoming available, especially spatially moved. Are you guys going to tackle something like that on a...
So I thought about it, and one of the things I should mention about incoherence is that the field width, the distance between this side of the screen and that side of the screen, is 6 inches, specifically so that when you're listening on headphones, it's a pretty good picture of where you feel like sounds are. You can change that number in the application, but when you start including more than one speaker, you would have to have variables for each of the different depths, the strength of the speaker in terms of the audio it's producing. We assume in a stereo configuration that the speakers are basically identical. Also, the subwoofer comes into play, and people have different cutoff frequencies for that. Plus, there's a new domain to look at. You're not just looking at left-right information, but you're looking at position in the room. So I can't think of an intuitive way.
Volumetric display of sound data.
Right, right. I think it would be much less interesting to look at, but it might be useful for I think it would be extremely useful for finding phase problems in 5.1 audio and eliminating them. Already, it's pretty useful for stereo. If you are curious whether an instrument is out of phase or not while you're mixing, you can flip it back and forth and look in the display. And if it centers up, then you know you're pretty close to in phase. But if it spreads way apart and you're on two different sides of the screen, you know you're out of phase. The problem with being out of phase is if anybody collapses your mix down to go to television broadcast or in some cases radio, most of that information is lost. When you take two out of phase signals and combine them, you end up with nothing. Any other questions?
Has this been a good business card?
It's been a lot of fun. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, so that was Incoherence. Our next speaker is Bjorn, who is showing, I believe, a color field camera. I'm going to pass this around since we really don't have any donations tonight, since we didn't have anybody standing at the door and glaring at you and making you feel guilty. So instead, I'm going to pass it around now and make you feel guilty.
What would a guilt? It's all for encounter.
It's all for encounter. While they're setting up, I think my daughter's going to talk for a moment.
So? The minute so on this is the single
Hello there. I just want to thank you all for showing up to the Encounter Studio. Wow, what a turnout. I founded this place about a year and a half ago with Aaron and Simran and a guy named Matt and a couple other people. And it's been a great time. I just want to tell you about a few little other cool events happening here at the Encounter Studio and one other really weird event that's happening. So this is just a teaser for very far in the future, something that might happen that you might hear about, so get ready for it now kind of thing, because I know every one of you is going to want to do this. It's called the Robot Rumble. And what people are doing is they're getting cardboards together and spray painting them silver and making these really cheesy little robot costumes, and they're going to have a big fight on a Friday night at an undisclosed location many months from now. So just start thinking in terms of your robot costume now, because it'll be a blast. And then we just have a lot of shows coming up here at the Encounter Studio, and one of them is the Performance Salon here Saturday night at 8, which I'm emceeing, and there'll be some performers there from my improv troupe that I have here. Thank you very much.
Now we have Bjorn, who's going to show us this really cool color field camera.
Hey, thanks for sticking around for this. I'm actually going to take a quick but slightly wider circle till we get to the camera, the color field camera. So what I've been looking at are Ubicomp mashups. So mashups are all the hype, right? Even IBM is getting in on the game, and IBM now has an official definition of what a mashup should be. Namely, that it's some web app that draws upon content retrieved from somewhere else, from external data sources. And sure enough, we see a whole bunch of these kinds of things online right now. This is David Shore's Weatherbong, extremely well-done site that pulls in something like 8,000 webcams and 9 different weather services to give you microclimates of San Francisco. But if you take a step back and look at what a mashup really is, it doesn't so much have to do with pulling in data from some other provider as in, you know, pulling in data, the activity, but in reusing content that's already out there and gluing pre-existing things together that are out there. And really your design is in the glueware that you use to combine pre-existing services. So sure enough, that happens in other fields, and the first comment on that Slashdot post on mashups was, sorry, that buzzword's already taken, namely in music, where you have combination of two or more different materials. And I want to take this larger view of mashups. So over the summer, I talked to a whole bunch of people from different fields who are not in Web 2.0 mashups and see what their kind of duct tape and hot glue designs are. A really interesting group are toy inventors, who they basically consider it part of their job to every week or two head to Toys R Us and just scan the aisles for whatever's new and wiggles in a new, in some kind of interesting way. They buy it, take it apart, Frankenstein it together with something else. So this is a prototype for some flashlight that has a mechanism. When you push it, opens, and then the light comes on. And they just took a monkey from Fisher-Price that already had that opening mechanism and just hacked some electronics inside for the light. Another example, this is a flying car where they just took a metal car and then the engines from a plastic airplane, glued those onto the sides, put their own custom electronics inside, and then just a little switch at the bottom of the car that senses whether the car is sitting on a horizontal surface or not. And whenever it's lifted up, you just start playing a sound. So what I've come up with so far is kind of this little graph that shows you, well, mashing has really been going on in a bunch of spaces for quite some time. There are Web 2.0 mashups that take web APIs and services and glue them to other web APIs and services. But there are also all the hardware hackers who take mechanisms and electronics and glue those to other mechanisms and electronics. And then there are, you know, all the shell scripts and macros of sysadmins that just glue desktop apps to each other. Now, what happens when you look at the melting pot of those three areas? So if you take apps that combine net infrastructure services and local applications and custom or off-the-shelf hardware, and that's what I'm really getting interested in. And I myself and some of my friends, we've built some projects, and I just want to show you one here. This is a mashup of mashups where we took the Flickr color picker, which is a graphical user interface application where you have this little color picker widget, and this is online, and as soon as you select one color, it shows you in the periphery just a selection of images pulled from Flickr that have the same dominant color as whatever you just have selected. And then the other ingredient I used was RGBY, a project from Japan, which is basically a one-pixel camera and projector in a square cube housing. So you put it over any color in the environment, senses that color, and then I think just has an RGB LED inside that mirrors that color throughout the cube. So what did I build? Well, this is the color field camera. This is a 1950s Herco Imperial snapshot camera that I bought off eBay, and then I put right behind the lens, gutted all the insides, put just a Logitech webcam, stripped off the housing, mounted it right behind the lens, and on the back side, dremeled out a hole and put an LCD screen in. So the demo gods permitting, we'll try to fire this up right now. Here is the camera. It has an umbilical. It's not a standalone thing. It needs laptop processing power at the moment. Start up our Python server here. And a Flash client. And this, what I'm projecting here right now, if we get rid of this face tracking nonsense, is what you would see on the back of the camera, but you don't, since I need the second VGA output right now to use the projector. But normally I just plug this LCD screen into the VGA output. And what you can see at the center of the visual field here, maybe we can actually see that camera. It came into view there for a second. Right there, there's the lens. Unfortunately, everything is red, and that's because of the lighting here in the room. But in the middle, I show you just a short snapshot of what the camera sees, and then the peripheral field shows you flicker images from the color fields group that match the dominant color of whatever you're looking at. So yes, please change the lighting. That's awesome. So as the lighting changes, you can see at about 3 to 5 hertz, I update what gets shown. And I have a couple of color cards here, so if we're lucky, how about green? There we go, green. All right, how about, well, orange we already had. What else do we have? There's a blue here. Can we get blue? Does that look blue to the camera? Doesn't look blue to the camera at the moment. That's too bad. How about pink? Oh, pink is good. And maybe yellow. So you get the idea. This is all it does. It's not gonna change the world, but really what I'm interested in is how can we get other people, you know, how do we make this kind of playful exploration available to more people? And let me switch back to slides for a moment. Because right now, and this is an easier one of the things I've built, this is kind of my language, my system diagram for what's going on here. So green are web services, blue is code that I wrote myself, orange is off-the-shelf software, and things in pink are physical input-output thingies. So the whole thing here happens in two steps. First, there's a Python script which just goes to the Flickr API and basically pre-process a couple thousand images, downloads them from Flickr, and does some very simple processing to find the dominant color of each of those. It then stores the files along with a database of those values onto disk, and then afterwards I have a Flash app written in ActionScript that has all the nice alpha blending, because that's really simple in Flash to do. And that ActionScript, about 3 to 5 times a second, does a remote procedure call to Python. Python takes an image using an attached webcam, processes that image, finds the nearest neighbor of all the database of images, sends that file name back to Flash. Flash loads that up and displays it. The whole thing then, if we're not hooked up to a projector through a scan converter, gets sent to the LCD screen that's built into the box. So simple concept, but in the end there's, I don't know, like 5 different scripts, 2 or 3 different programming languages involved. So how can we make this simpler? And if you have any ideas on that, please talk to me. Another example for which I don't have a demo is in our lab, we have this awesome whiteboard wall, which is just 3 panels of, you know, $13, 8x4 foot tile board, turn an entire wall into a whiteboard. And we build a whiteboard capture system where we hack the Staples Easy button. You push that button and a camera mounted in the ceiling of that room takes a picture of that whiteboard, does kind of the whole rectification, and then just uploads it to Flickr and shows the image to you in a browser, so you're sure you can erase whatever's on that whiteboard and draw your own stuff over it. And that's even more of a mess. So I'll end right there. If you have questions, please shoot them. Yes?
It's not just the complexity of the components, it's also all these things continuously change and break.
Oh, so yeah, debugging and maintaining anything.
You reload that and like you update all your software and it's going to be broken by itself.
Yeah, so one of the problems we've definitely identified is, yeah, what happens when your software changes? What happens when someone else walks in and says, that's really cool, I want one of those too? It's almost impossible to distribute anything like that at the moment. So I'm toying around with some ideas of maybe just packaging everything up in a virtual machine and shipping that across, since disk space and bandwidth are free. But yeah, there are no solutions. There's a whole bunch of cool demos you can put together right now, but they kind of raise more problems than they answer.
You're saying you can transform this into a giant big file that is all about inserting software and the block that system.
Yeah, I think the makefile is actually too complex. So my idea is just basically to make a copy of your entire system configuration together with all the programs and everything just as a virtual machine and ship it as one packet across. One packet that's a couple gigabytes in size, but...
Well, when you have all this put together, at least the previous one, not this one, this would be a little hard to package up.
Yep.
It seems that as long as there's a steady API, and Flickr's API is versioned, the way you get back and forth, you know, to your scan converter's hardware out of Flash, sounds like if you just made Glue library, it would continue to work until somebody broke something really important, like the Flickr API, or like the interface to Logitech webcams.
Right, like the Logitech webcam driver, which likes to update itself.
Well, no, I'm thinking in terms of if you're running under, say, Linux, or even if you're running under Windows, you don't have to let the Logitech webcam driver update itself. You can use the Windows API to get to the cam, and then you can ignore the camera's API. You're using the Windows deobject.
Right. So, however, what I want to highlight here is all of this, right, and especially this. Come on. You can write all of that in one programming language. It'll just be no fun and take you forever. The whole idea of the mashup is just,
make it work.
You know, calling Flickr is easiest from Python because it's 5 lines. Doing some GUI is easiest in C# because they already give you all the tools. And doing camera capture, well, there's only one API in one language that comes with that camera, so you don't really have a choice. So I think we're stuck with these hybrid monsters anyways and just have to find some other way of dealing with it.
There are a number of systems sort of coming out now, for instance, making that does a very good job of componentizing builds.
What system was that?
And manages a lot of the process maintaining relationships and version information between different components, so managing each of those separately in a build environment. It does have some concept of deploy environment.
That sounds great. I'll be happy to look into that. Cool. Other questions and comments?
But you have to bring this name in the way.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so next up, our next open dork is a... Yeah, I know, just a second, sweetie. Our next open dork is a project in progress for the upcoming next month, Robo Exotica, which is a group called Monochrome puts on a robot drink-making festival. And so we have a robot drink-making machine that I understand is built atop of a robotic pipette system, and I hear nothing but the fire is working yet. So at least you get fire. Do you like to talk about it for a moment, Simone?
Sure.
No, more fire.
Okay, well, Simone will give us some more fire. For those of you who don't know Simone, she also is does Suicide Bots, a great robot blog, and she works for the Long Now Foundation and like robot games and SRL and really, you know, anything having to do with machines. This woman and and this is how small children and robots work together. I've seen Mark Pauline's son operate machines at SRL, and it goes about the same. Nobody's died yet.
Start the
Okay, so this is my ridiculous little machine. It's called El Español Borracho, which means the drunken Spaniard, for those of you who are not quite as bilingual as everyone else is. It's almost out of fuel, so I'm going to turn it off so I don't kill myself. This is only about a third of it. The only part that's working is the fire part. It's going to make a Spanish coffee eventually, which is you flame some kind of flammable, edible liquid, and then you pour coffee over it and cream and whatever. But I can't figure out how to put a coffee maker on it, so it's just going to be Kahlua and 151 rum. We're running field tests tomorrow night at my house. If you want to bring rum and Kahlua, everyone's welcome. It's ridiculously hacked together. The base is part of a VEX kit that I cut apart and did horrible things to. This pump is from a micropipetter. It's actually a syringe pipetter. It's actually kind of cool. A friend of mine found it at a flea market and got really excited and said, "I have this thing for you." He called like 2 o'clock in the morning, and he handed me this box of hardware, and that was what it was. So it was very exciting for me. I'm getting way too excited about vinyl tubing lately, because a lot of it's vinyl tubing. This is a food-safe plastic container for whatever, and it has a vinyl tubing thing coming out of it, and that's where the 151 will go. The Kahlua goes in the middle. It's held down very tastefully by stripper shoe straps, Violet approved. Yeah, right on, Violet approves. I have a little rubber thing down here that says Cthulhu Vatagan, just because, and it holds the alcohol thing in place. And it's eventually going to end up on the chassis of a little robot that my husband put together, which was made for robot hockey. It's like this little Lexan thing, and it's got little pointy bits on it, and it's all clear and pretty and beautiful, and it fits exactly right, so I'm thinking it's going to run around and variously flame people's toes if they're not paying attention, and ask them to have it make them a drink. I'm toying with the idea of putting an LCD display on top that says "Watch out" in German and English. We'll see if I get that far.
Trilingual.
What?
It'll be trilingual if you do that.
It will be trilingual if I do that, actually, yeah. I should have three displays, when one was Spanish, too. The flamethrower is a ridiculously hacked-together thing that looks really unsafe, and probably is. It's got a big old spark plug and a huge transformer and a really tiny set of tanks on it. It runs on butane propane camping fuel, so I can fuel up at any outdoor store, which is really cool, and it's all kind of hacked together and electronically enabled. Looks like it was done by blind monkey.
Data dropped. 3 minutes of audio was not recorded. My bad.
Coffee maker would, so I may as well just put an actual coffee maker on it, you know. Yeah, then I'd have to refill the I guess I'm refilling the alcohol all the time anyway, so I just kind of like the idea of getting everyone really wasted and then having them be really wasted and trying to drink a beverage that's on fire. Yeah. So, yeah.
Breathalyzer next to the igniter.
That, see, where would be the fun, you know? Gwen, and then what's his name?
I just want to say I have at least 3 coffee makers that are about this big, as well as an LED panel about this big. You can program anything to say or prompt it to donate to your project.
Field tests, my house, tomorrow.
Yeah.
Jake. Thank you. Jake.
How are you playing with fly with this?
With great difficulty. We fly with robots all the time. We have a nice official-looking lockable briefcase that has business cards from SF State plastered all over it that says, "Robotics Department, please do not mess with. Please, please, oh please, this is not a bomb. This is a robot project." And so far, we haven't been hassled. And we have gone to Germany and London with it, and no one's really screamed at us too much. So you just have to kind of look really innocent. Golly, wires. You know, anyone else? Anyone? What? I might do that. That would be cool too. I would like to have actual coffee in it, because a Spanish coffee is a very nice thing when it's made properly.
It's not gonna happen here.
It's not. No. Anyway, anyone else?
The coffee maker that was at the robot coffee maker that was at the San Mateo thing. Did you see that?
The maker fair?
Yeah.
No, I did not see it. I was dealing with all of our other robots.
You will open source this?
Oh, sure. Why not?
Have to kill yourself with the flamethrower.
Have to kill yourself with the... It's actually not very hot. You can stick your hand in the flame. It it'll just kind of singe you slightly. Anybody else? Can I go now? Can I? Anyone? Okay.
All right. Was there anybody else who wanted to do an open dork tonight? Why don't you come up? So is there anybody that's after him, just so I can know that we're done once he's done?
When we're done, that means it's drinking time.
Oh, he's built us another Dorkbot donation box, which is animatronic, which is somehow appropriate, rather than this boring, you know, put money in a slot thing. I guess we're getting a demo back there if you want to watch of its hot animatronic action. Oh, all right, and once that's done, Vail will have an announcement. So there you see the animatronic. Thank you. You're staying on the cord.
That's okay.
So it's a sign that takes a binary. It's just a relay.
Get the stuff. All right, I'll let you know.
So, Vail has an announcement of some sort, I think.
Hey, thanks, Simone. That was an awesome demonstration. Are you going to RoboExotica? So am I, and I found out that Violet is too. Are you going, Karen? Well, Karen, you're responsible for me going, I'm sure. I know. I'm V. Vail from Research, and I'm just wanted to announce that we're having a Pranks Fest coming up Saturday, November 11th at the Art Institute. It's early, 7 o'clock sharp, so certain people here can go to another party afterwards. And anyway, I just thought I'd let you know.
What is that? It's
PM.
Details let me get mail.
Okay, Saturday. Thanks, Babalu. November 11th, Saturday, at the San Francisco Art Institute, 800 Chestnut in North Beach. We're having a celebration of our new Pranks book. It's called the Pranks Fest. So we hope you attend.
Mark Powell is...
Oh, right, Mark. Yes, thanks, Karen. Yeah, Mark Powell will be giving a presentation. Food hacker. I like that.
And best hacker of the day.
Oh, really? Great. So anyway, thanks, Karen, for putting on this amazing event, Dorkbot. Thanks. Well, we have a question. Who's going to be at the Pranks Fest? Well, gee, some of them are kind of illegal. And so we are having a presentation, some video, it'll be basically short video clips and then talking and Q&A from the audience interspersed, and the Billboard Liberation Front doing very illegal things. Yes, there will be someone from there. And besides Mark Powell, we're actually having the MC is going to be a senior prankster, Mal Sharp, who is on our first Pranks book. He's actually going to show some video of him doing a prank, 40 years ago or something, where he went into a restaurant and, anyway, never mind. You'll have to see it. And good question. There are some more anonymous people going to show up. I don't know if there's any superstars I can name that might show up. We might have the founder of Devo there, the band, if you've ever heard of that, but we'll see. So thanks. So you can get a flyer from me if you want it. It's November 11th, Saturday, real soon.
All right, thank you, everybody. There is, again, a donation-based bar at the back, and you can mill around for a while. I'll say as long as you like, because nobody's told me when you have to leave. So, hey. why don't you give me these chips?